By way of housekeeping, I should just say that ordinarily I would expect to hold office hours immediately after class for those who would like to talk. Unfortunately, today I can't. So first office hours after this class will be tomorrow morning at 10:30. Given that I can't see you this afternoon unless I am absolutely jammed with 1Ls tomorrow afternoon, you're also welcome to drop in tomorrow afternoon between 3 and 5 if you want to talk. Having said which, if you would now like to talk, questions, comments, assertions, counter-propositions, anything left over from last week, why don't teachers ask for questions at the beginning of class? After all, you are accustomed to the ritual that questions are to be asked afterwards instead of first. Why? Don't bother, I turned it off.
Because the teachers already know what they want to say, and you're going to turn them off.
Yeah, correct. That's one reason. For protection. The class exists already, and to take a question at the beginning is to risk disrupting. Obviously, I don't give a shit about that. There must be some reason, but we'll pursue that another time. The consequence, however, is that you're also granted a permission not to think in between classes. To ask if there are questions is to imply that people might have had a thought in between classes, or had something that was important to them that we didn't get a chance to talk about, and that has been riding around with them in their pocket for a week, waiting for a chance. If you don't ask, then, of course, that creates the understanding that no thinking has occurred in between, and nothing has occurred to anybody that it would be important to begin with. The consequence is to protect the continuity of the teaching, while at the same time providing an inherent reinforcement to not doing any thinking in between. This is a particularly good idea if the course is terminated by an examination, so that everything you ever thought can only be put after the course is over. Even better if in the meantime all the questions asked are questions by the teacher. All of this is bad. And you help to formulate the revolution if you have a question at the beginning of class. It's okay, I'll figure out what to do. That's my job. You ask a question, I answer it, I try to decide whether that's where we start or not where we start, or whether I should revise my argument in light of the questions asked. All the people who think that they should be on the Supreme Court could function that way if they were on the Supreme Court, but they don't actually belong on the Supreme Court. It's questionable whether they belong in a classroom. Okay, there aren't any questions, nonetheless. Good, wonderful, how nice. Now I can do exactly what I intended. The right of the people, in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, to be against unreasonable search and seizure shall not be violated. No warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. We are now in this 21st century, whatever the hell it is, imagining what those words would mean to us. And one question before the House is whether what they should mean to us is what they meant. This is called originalism, although it is way more complicated than originalism and way more burdensome than just making up whatever you think the Founding Fathers said and supporting it with a quotation from Google. But if what the words meant is relevant to what we are imagining that they mean now, the reason, which is the one stated by Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. 125 years ago in The Path of Law, is that we wish to predict how the courts will decide future cases. In the world of the functioning Fourth Amendment, which is taken to be a set of rules about criminal procedure, naturally the thing we are trying to predict is whether the client is going to go to jail. Which tends to mean, of course, whether the evidence is going to be suppressed. That's an odd distillation of everything that went into those words, but for practical purposes, that is generally what we mean when we think about Fourth Amendment problems in the current legal environment, whatever the complexity of the facts outside, whatever is in the defendant's pocket when he was arrested, etc., etc. But the fundamental understanding of this is shaped by the remedy, by exclusion. And as legal realists, we begin with the remedy in the Fourth Amendment world in the same way that we begin with the remedy in the contracts class, where the hairy hand displaces the discussion of offer and acceptance in a modern contracts course, a realist contracts course, because of the implicit understanding that really matters is what are the courts going to do if this agreement falls to pieces among the parties who made it, and a remedy has to be devised to decide what should happen next. And in the world of this 18th century sentence, therefore, almost everything comes to hinge upon a 20th century version of an imaginary remedy, namely the suppression of evidence in a criminal prosecution. And almost everything we're going to say, therefore, is going to turn out to be about, for these practical purposes, what will occur in criminal prosecutions based on various forms of digital surveillance. But we should wait before we allow all that gap to be crossed, and to think of this as only about a question of what a remedy will be in a criminal prosecution hypothetically arising out of a context which involved some digital searching. If we are to understand what the meaning of what we're dealing with is, unless it really is just a question, as Charles Evans Hughes says, that the Constitution of the United States is what 5 votes on the Supreme Court say it is, in which case it hardly matters what any 18th century sentence meant. But if we are really to try and understand what the political institution that this sentence represents is to those who made it, we should begin by recognizing that seizure is as important a word as search, and arrest is as important as prosecution to the meaning of the word. Arrest is, after all, not search, the primary form of frightening thuggery. The primary form in which state violence occurring in an unreasonable fashion may threaten the security of people is that you get picked up. You're a billionaire. You're staying, as you usually do, in the top-ass suite in some Hong Kong 7.25-star hotel. And then suddenly one day you are wrapped in bandages, sitting in a wheelchair, being brought out through the lobby by a bunch of guys in sharkskin suits, never to be seen again. That was in Hong Kong, and that wasn't supposed to happen to you, but you're in China now, kid. That's the frightening thing. The 18th century authors of the 18th century sentence about an 18th century Anglo-American legal dispute arising out of 17th century English political circumstances are concerned most with that one. The people who come and pick you up and throw you into the back of a van and that's it. This sentence is mostly about that. And the remedy which it proposes, which it is absolutely undergirded and supported by, is the writ of habeas corpus. The really important part of this in asserting the civil liberty of Americans in the face of the new empire being constructed in Philadelphia in 1787, the real grammatical and semantic and political weight of this sentence is, this empire will not have vans and thugs, and it can't just throw you in the back off the street and that's the end of you. This is what in 1678 Parliament accomplished when it created the Habeas Corpus Act. Of course, it didn't actually. It was a joke. The tellers in the House of Lords on the vote in the Lords on the Habeas Corpus Act counted as 10 votes, one extremely corpulent lord. And the arithmetic of the parliamentary vote was jiggered in that sense. But everybody knew that to revise or withdraw the special statutory role given to the writ of habeas corpus would produce, as it did 10 years later, a revolution. A king lost his place, the Stuart monarchy disappeared, and the nature of English monarchy was forever reconfigured, primarily over this question, whether imprisonment at discretion could occur in England. To a reactionary British Tory of the 18th century, like, say, Samuel Johnson, this is the distinguishing difference between England and the despotic regimes of the continent. This is why we are not the French, because habeas corpus. Because no Englishman confined by governmental power anywhere could be kept in durance vile without appearing in court within 24 hours of an order saying to the confining official, produce the body of this person in our courtroom and show why you are entitled to be retaining him. And if all you have is an order of executive power, that's not good enough, and we will free him. Free him. So to understand this sentence, we have to begin by understanding that arrest, which we no longer, by and large, consider to be relevant to this story, arrest is the primary concern, the seizure of the person. And no order may be given to a subsidiary official but as a warrant based on an assertion of probable cause supported by oath or affirmation particularly describing a place and a person. And without that, nothing. And the remedy isn't suppression of evidence. The remedy is freedom. By the strongest machinery for the protection of civil liberties known to the European law. And this the Americans are attaching to an empire about which the members of the first Congress and a substantial number of the citizens of the new imperial republic are afraid. That's security. The question of whether we have that security or not is open, of course. A profound subject. Because what if in the course of arrest somebody kneels on a man's neck for 7 minutes and he dies? What if somebody winds up shot several times or even a couple of dozen in the back or is carrying some police buckshot in him to the end of his days because arrest? It's odd, in a way, to watch the cases talk about the remedy of suppression. Because, of course, the really important remedy was freedom, and freedom is what you can't have after the cops have put a bullet in your back, or 10. So that discussion, a discussion about the nature of the remedy for seizure, and what makes seizure unreasonable, and what it is that allows the coercive power of the state to put somebody in the back of the van, that's really the most important subject here. We, of course, are going to be worrying about email, and text messages, and shit in the phone that the guy shouldn't have been carrying in the first place. But it's important, if we're really going to pay attention to this as though the meaning of the words counts, that we begin by noticing the fundamental displacement. We're talking about the second meaning of the these words. So when we understand that the Fourth Amendment is being adapted to the maximum extent of the possible in order to deal with social and technical and political circumstances completely outside the realm of its foundation, we're not talking about what the founding fathers would have thought about smart-ass phones. That already is at the other end of a transformation of the constitutional concern. From a sentence which begins in dealing with the most important fear of despotism, which is the desaperezados of some imaginary federal despotism, we don't actually disappear a lot of Americans, but there are way too many people in the street with police bullets in their backs. Because, of course, whatever they thought about thuggery, they didn't imagine a world of 400 million handguns and a police cruiser in San Jose, California with a shotgun strapped to the dashboard. A sight which always made me cringe, even though I knew they were never going to come for me. So we're looking at a piece of a meaning, the one about search, and the one where seizure means they take your laptop and they do what they want with it and 12 years later you get it back. We're concentrating on that, and we're trying to understand how to adapt that 18th century meaning to 21st century circumstances. But the place we have to begin is with the notes that aren't being played. Because whatever the principles are of security against being tossed in the back of a van and never being seen again, we regard those as settled, and we don't think that 21st century circumstances have significantly altered it. And to the extent that we have wandered away from the world of real habeas and real freedom from thuggery, we wandered away on a different trajectory, which had to do with the extent to which we were prepared to accept permanent paramilitarization of society on the street in order to obtain what a fine, upstanding public servant like the current mayor of the city of New York calls the safety of the people. Safety and security are there, oddly, antonyms, or at least intention. But we're trying to scrape out of the secondary subject, the searching thugger, some set of rules that are meaningful to the society in which we now find ourselves, or at least at which you would find yourself if you really understood what the technology was doing to you. And even then, the end of the process, which is determined, as any legal realist would say, by the result, the end of the process is either some evidence is successfully objected to, or it isn't. And as to that, well, here's a story. Once upon a time, in the late 20th century, I was attending a conference on the origins of the 14th Amendment, and among the people there was an evil judge. His primary evilness had to do with his extraordinary sophistication at figuring out how to keep black people and Spanish people in Texas from voting against the political candidates preferred by white people. He was a fringe member of the, is a fringe member of the Bush family, and an occasional name in dialogue about who might sit on the Supreme Court if a Republican is in the White House. And he was then, on that day that we were talking to one another, a dangerous judge. Much of what he was dangerous about in the year 1991, which this was, has subsequently happened, not by him, but by John Roberts. And we are where we are with respect to voting rights in America. But we were talking about the roots of the 14th Amendment, of course, and therefore, the night before the story I'm about to tell you, we had a knockdown, drag-out fight about the death penalty, of which he was, as a Texan, of course, extremely fond, and of which I was, as a Jew from New York, extremely not fond. At any rate, we had a nasty fight about the death penalty over dinner, and the following morning we were making up and laughing about things and being, you know, lawyers like ourselves. And so we were talking about the exclusionary rule, because that's a place for lawyers to laugh together. And the judge says, well, he says, I'll tell you a story. So I'm now two stories in. I'll close all the parentheses before we continue. But remember, you're two stories in now. He said, we were down in San Antonio sitting by designation because of what happened. What he meant by what happened was the murder of District Judge John Wood in San Antonio in 1988, the only time that a federal judge has ever been murdered for hire by the thugs of a drug dealer. And after the murder of Judge Wood, the federal appellate judges in Texas all sat in rotation by designation in the SD tags in order to help clean the docket and keep things running after the very disruptive murder of Judge Wood. So he says, we were down sitting by designation in San Antonio because of what happened, he said. And one day I came down. He, of course, is a Texan of a totally different kind and lives in Dallas. So I was down in San Antonio one day, said, and I heard a bunch of suppression motions, one after the other, all day long. He said, and I found it a very disconcerting experience, he said, because, of course, he's a Court of Appeals judge and a candidate for the Supreme Court, and he doesn't get much dirt under his fingernails under ordinary circumstances. He said, I found the day very distressing in a way, listening to all those motions. He said, at the end of the day, I went back to the airport to fly home, and the Chief Assistant United States Attorney for the district was in the departure lounge with me. And he was joshing me. He said, Judge, you know, you had a real day in the real world now, down here sitting as a district judge. Yeah, I said, I just heard a day of suppression motions. How was it, says the AUSA. Well, I said, it was a little bit odd. They were all quite patterned, I would say. Every one of them was, well, Judge, he was weaving back and forth across the yellow line, and so I pulled him over. And when I pulled him over, as I walked up, there was an overpowering smell of marijuana from the car. And I said to the Chief AUSA, I heard 12 of those today, I think, or maybe it was 14. All the same. And the Chief AUSA just laughed at me. And he said, Judge, I'll tell you a story. Now I'm three stories in. He said, one year, the price of sugar on the Mexican border just went through the floor. And the sugar growers of the United States were getting pissy about it. And I got a rocket from Maine Justice, pleased to bring some illegal importation of sugar cases stat. Now, I didn't have any resources for investigating illegal importation of sugar cases. We're busy down here. So I put some DEA agents on it. And in due course, they made some arrests. And in due course, the defendants moved to suppress. And I saw my agent on the morning of the suppression hearing. And I said to him, so what's up? And he said to me, oh, listen, it's a terrific collar, he said. He was weaving back and forth across the yellow line. And so I pulled him over. And when I walked up, there was an overpowering smell of sugar from the car. And I just looked at the agent and I said, what the hell are you talking about? Sugar doesn't smell. And the agent looked back at me and he said, okay, smartass, you tell me. What happened? Close parenthesis, 3, 2, 1. Because, of course, that's the problem, okay? There was no warrant because he was weaving back and forth across the yellow line. And I pulled him up, and then there was an overpowering smell of something, and I had me a crime. And once I had me the crime, then I went and testified that there was an overpowering smell of this or that, and then the suppression motion fails, and then the evidence comes in, and Bob's your uncle. And I got one more collar on my record, and the prosecutor's happy, and Maine Justice is happy, and the guys who conduct, well, they would call it debt peonage, but let's be fair, it's slavery to make sugar and Florida, they're happy too. Everybody's great. And the Constitution is fine because it was a fair cop, search incident to arrest, overpowering smell of this or that. Now you're done. In other words, before we get to the 21st century problem, let's just understand the 20th century problem. Let's just recognize that the fundamental dispute at the end of the day comes to be over why it is that we don't admit evidence produced by policing like that, whatever it was. Because, of course, policing like that is a little drama played for the court. And it's a drama played for the court, which everybody understands to be drama. And the word reasonable comes to mean something like plausible dramatics. I've sat in a federal district courtroom watching that play go down. I have seen some DEA agent asked, "Did you read him his rights?" We're now on the Fifth Amendment side of this, right? And have the agent say, "Why, yes, Judge, of course I did." And then he fishes in his immense pants pocket for his immense wallet, and he pulls out his immense wallet in the court, and he leafs through it, and he comes out with the Miranda warnings card from the depth of his wallet, and he holds it at arm's length out and reads it as though it were written in Sanskrit, but he sort of understands it. And then everybody nods and smiles, and it's fine, and the defendants are on their way to 6 to 8. So the question comes to be about the dramatic sufficiency of the background to the admission of some evidence. After Map Against Ohio, that drama is played out not merely in the federal courts about the half a dozen things that result in federal criminal prosecution most of the time, and before the war on drugs, that was a much smaller number. After Map, that has to be played out every time that anything is introduced anywhere that comes from a search incident to arrest, or that comes from a search warrant issued on an oath or affirmation, or rather a bunch of affidavits from anonymous informants A, B, C, D, and E, and cops 1 and 2. Constitutionalizing criminal procedure in that Warren Court sense, making Section 1 of the 14th Amendment guarantee to every person in every state this right of security, ultimately is a system of screenwriting. It's drama. You've seen it too, because it's on the television shows, and it's part of the recognizable literary structure of American criminal of American criminal adjudication. Into this world drops the smartass phone. And all the other technological miracles of one kind or another, from the infrared sensing gear, you know, in Kilo, to the improved structures of the cell phone search in Riley, all the business of the process of getting evidence and putting it in, which comes to depend primarily on the dramaturgical resources of the agent and the prosecutor. What is the AUSA supposed to do when his agent says to him, "Okay, smartass, you tell me what happened"? What is the prosecutor supposed to do? Obviously, to answer that question by telling him what happened so he can tell it to the court is close to the facilitation of perjury. And if the AUSA has any respect for her own law license, she's unlikely to do that. On the other hand, telling the agent, "You can't testify, you're a fucking liar, go," that's not what prosecutors do. They can't do that. Back when my dear and respected, and I do mean both dear and deeply respected, colleague Judge Jerry Lynch was doing his second term as a prosecutor, as the chief criminalist in the Southern District of New York, after one such episode or other in the legal life of New York City, I said, "Jerry, what do you do when an agent lies like that? What do you do?" You're the guy who sets the tone for the prosecutorial behavior of the most important district in the United States. He said, oh, it's very simple. He said, I call the agent in charge, and I say, I never want to see that so-and-so in any one of my cases ever again. That is at least what one very good AUSA does under those circumstances. But, of course, that doesn't mean the agent gets fired. That means that testimony is now being given in Cheyenne, Wyoming, or wherever it is that the Bureau or the DEA put him after he got failed in the big time on Broadway. Therefore, whatever we say, even if I came here and I told you there is a way to make the Fourth Amendment written in 1790 and adopted by the states in 1791 and based on principles from the 1760s, working their way out of the constitutional crisis of the English monarchy in the 1670s and 80s, even if I came to you and said, we can adjust all that language perfectly so that it makes total sense out of AWS and cryptocurrency and smart-ass phones and all the rest of it, even if I said that, we would still be back to the mere drama of the how they get it in. Because all we're talking about is how they get it in. Seizure is at most that of objects, not of persons. And the security of persons is you robbed a bank carrying a goddamn mobile phone and the mobile phone towers located you in the neighborhood of the bank, and should that evidence come in or not? This is not what protection against despotism really depends on. I mean to say, then, that the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment is not merely that 18th century language ill suits 21st century concerns, or that the nature of the constitutional structure that the 18th century gave birth to is not a structure meant to constrain the forms of despotism which are now at the behest of either the Chinese Communist Party on the one hand or the FBI on the other. I mean to say that the Fourth Amendment's tragic failure under 21st century conditions is also the failure of our system in the late 20th century, because everything came to depend upon the exclusion of evidence, and the exclusion of evidence as a remedy is deliberately misunderstood and misframed. Look, for example, at Herring. The United States Supreme Court knows, because even though there are an awful lot of people who sit on the United States Supreme Court who have never really done anything, almost all of them have done enough to understand the difference between the criminal procedure question, should this evidence come in, and the policing policy question, how do we deter lying and misbehavior by paramilitaries working for our interests in civil and domestic peace? This is why I felt I had to say something to that National Guard sergeant after Steve Breyer walked through the line. Steve Breyer knows perfectly well that we're not trying to deter police misbehavior. We're trying to protect the integrity of the courts. Steve Breyer understands that the connection of thuggery to the processes of justice tarnishes the ambition of the empire to do justice to the people who live here and to make the people secure. But at the end of the day, although I don't mean that Justice Breyer would have endorsed the result in Herring, he doesn't endorse the result in Herring, but the logic of the Chief Justice in Herring is not answerable. Well, this is only about deterrence, and if on the balance that we don't deter much cop misbehavior if we suppress the evidence in this case, and the bad news is somebody we think is clearly guilty is going to walk, then, well, you know, whatever it was that was being done, and it doesn't really matter. You could swap the facts in Herrick for the facts in Riley or the facts in Kilo. Whatever it is that was being done, suppressing the evidence is not beneficial enough to be worth the cost of the, well, the defendant goes free because the constable blundered, and we're back with the nonsense of Justice Cardozo from 75 years earlier. But the preservation of the integrity of justice is not a sufficient motivation. We need to understand that. The fundamental way in which we use the criminal law, which is itself merely demonstrative, merely dramatic, merely a way of acting out that we are not like those animals over there, whoever they are, the way we use the criminal law inevitably puts the remedy at risk of this form of just unprincipled constitutional cost-benefit analysis, in which the dirtiness done to the courts of admitting evidence taken in violation of the citizens' rights to security is not the cost. The cost is reckoned as the defendant going free. And the benefit is, but the cops won't ever do it again, all of which is falsity, a deliberate misunderstanding, not this meaning. You're going to be originalist about it. You won't hear of any of that. But of course, originalism in our current dogmatic sense is entirely consistent with that fundamental misunderstanding of what the constitutional text is about. The remedy draws unto itself all the hostility. The suppression of evidence is the denial of truth. Where behind that is the power of thuggery to make its own truth. What's the truth about what Peng Shuai meant when she sent a message? It's beyond discovery. The truth has been eliminated by thuggery, by coercion, by the people in the van. Should we be conducting our cost-benefit analysis in every prosecution with respect to every suppression motion on the basis of the power of thuggery to create its own truth if we let it? Yes, we should, except that we won't. That's not the way we're going to think about the meaning of these words. That's not just preface, but it's mostly preface, because of course I do want to talk about smart-ass phones and heat sensing and all the other little bits and pieces of the 21st century encounter with the Fourth Amendment. From the point of view of the British North Americans who made this, the most important crime is smuggling. And the most important thing being smuggled is sugar water. The real factual substrate of the conflict in the late First British Empire, before the American Revolution, over searching, is the British Empire's revenue interest in taxing every gallon of molasses entering North America. I mean, it's just a tiny little piece of an enormous global fact, which I suppose we're not supposed to talk about nowadays. On the one hand, if we talk about it in the United States, it's critical race theory and it's forbidden. And if we talk about it in England, it's doing bad things to the statue of Edward Colston and destroying history and et cetera, et cetera. So let's just try and be clear about it. The wealth of the First British Empire consists of agricultural commodities produced primarily by enslaved persons, and the calories thus produced in which to feed workers. You need to keep that second part in mind. By the time that the First British Empire is behaving in a Christian fashion and beginning to deprecate the slave trade, the caloric intake of English factory workers, those proletarians you see in the background, somebody tells you that Marx isn't right about anything, The proletarian diet of the English working class, more than 50% of its calories come from sugar. That's the sweet tea and the horrible English cake and all that other tooth-rotting structure of the English working class diet. Those calories are made in the islands of the Caribbean by slaves. The sugar leaves the islands in the form of molasses. It comes to places like New York City, where people like, say, one Nicholas Roosevelt, the scion of a subsequently quite distinguished family in the United States, boil the molasses down and distill rum out of it and send the rum out into the North Atlantic. And after 1761, the cost of the British Empire's military protection, naval and military protection, of all of that production and the wealth that it produces, hinges on the ability to collect 5 pence on a gallon of molasses as it enters North America from the Caribbean. But of course, the boilers of Manhattan and Rhode Island and Boston, the refiners and the sugar traders, and they have no intention of paying that nickel on a gallon. Even if the price, even if the tariff is subsequently reduced to a penny and a half, as it will be around the time of the Stamp Act, they're still not paying. Because there's just a long coastline of North America, and you can offload a bunch of barrels of molasses in the middle of the night and not pay any taxes, and that's the big crime. Smuggling. Which means that a whole bunch of the forms of push and shove between power and the people in the late colonial British North American economy are really about folks not wanting to pay taxes on sugar water, and therefore they're having warehouses full of untaxed molasses, and therefore the revenue authorities of the British North American Empire wishing to deputize local constables to go and search people's basements looking for barrels of molasses on which tax hasn't been paid. The smell of sugar, yet again, I wish to point out, just in case you happen to be keeping track of how empires are built and destroyed. But I also mean to suggest that it's not surprising that from the point of view of those who think that this is unconstitutional thuggery, the problem is that it's all about molasses taxation. It's just like strangling a guy in the street in the middle of the day for selling Lucy's. Of course, there isn't any guy being strangled. The people getting hurt by growing that sugar are somewhere else, and nobody's paying much attention to them. But still, the disorder lies in the sense of being subjected to a kind of thuggery over something so trivial that in the end it's beneath the dignity of a man to accept that kind of treatment. And the people who think it's beneath the dignity of a man are going to go on at some length about how they refuse to be made slaves to the revenue system. At the end, therefore, the disputes about whether to admit the evidence are both overwhelmingly important and some, in some deep sense, trivial. As they have been all this time in the United States in the late 20th century about a carton of this and a container of that in the back of an automobile. And the destruction of lives on the basis of all of that is just as clear when the tea got dumped in Boston Harbor as it was when everybody simultaneously decided to let weed transact in a free market and stop sending hapless people to jail for the smell of their cars. Part of the difficulty that we therefore experience when we try and turn all this material into something that can actually preserve freedom in the 21st century, in the age of the net, given the pervasive surveillance of everybody everywhere by one or another form of everything, when that's the problem that we're dealing with, one of the oddities is we have to take the Fourth Amendment really seriously for the first time. And no wonder it collapses when we do. Because although its ambition is of the highest and the best, And its purpose is to make despotism impossible under circumstances in which despotism was difficult to start with. It doesn't bite very deeply when it comes to the problems against which we are about to measure it. Questions or comments now? Now that went down too easy. All right, well, maybe next week you'll have a question. Think about it. So here we are then. We're attempting to do something quite, well, non-originalist. We're attempting to take this sentence seriously, not over the question of arbitrary arrest, which we self-confidently and incorrectly believe ourselves to have dealt with, and not with respect to the kind of narrow calculation over the value of the remedy of exclusion, even if you take the judicial integrity relevant meaning of the remedy seriously, let alone if you're willing to be caught up in this sterile cost-benefit analysis of, but Your Honor, the guy was guilty anyway. And this isn't going to dissuade the cops because they were making an honest mistake. They thought there was a warrant. Yeah, they lied. Yeah, the cop was the person who erased it from the database. Yeah, this, that doesn't really matter. After all, you're not going to deter them from doing what in all good conscience they're supposed to do, and which they had a mistaken belief they were doing, with their fingers crossed behind their backs, as they always are. Because to the cops, it's just a drama. It's just a little game. They know who's guilty. They're the cops. They know what the evidence is. They're the cops. What the courts do? Well, they're cops. They think that's all a fancy pants game anyway. But we need all of this to come out and expand in water like a Japanese paper flower. We need all of this suddenly to burgeon. We need all of these pieces that had different meanings and that worked in pretty creaky ways and that were really subject to being wished away by capable police testimony. We need all of that suddenly to turn into something that can prevent the forms of exacting and endless and unrelenting surveillance that 21st century society can perform. It isn't going to work. Now, I don't disagree with the realism of Charles Evans Hughes. If Sonia Sotomayor comes to work one day and discovers that she has 5 votes for the principle that third-party custodians of data should be subject to the responsibility to create warrant resistance and to use constitutional muster and power of their own on behalf of the ordinary citizens whose data they collect, if she can do that because she has 5 votes, then she can do that. She has 5 votes. And we could write the opinion for her because it would be full of large, valuable, interesting language about history and freedom and the traditions of the English people and their law. And I mean, the rhetoric is easy. It writes itself. But the 5 votes and the rhetoric both are merely speculative. They're just a dream. They don't exist. And part of the reason that they don't exist is it's really hard to turn this into what you want. Why is it hard to turn this into what you want? Well, in the first place, because of place. Because the Fourth Amendment's protection against despotism is essentially localist. It depends upon the absence of that great big workforce of government lickspittles willing to throw anything into a van or to oppress anybody in order to please power. The Fourth Amendment is designed to prevent a weak system from getting stronger, not to prevent a strong system from doing what it wants. And because the way that it restrains power is by tying its action to a place and demanding that that place have been thought about by independent judicial power of some kind, some magistrate or other. The placing us of the Fourth Amendment, its determination that everything should have a local habitation and a name, that everything in the end comes down to places being searched, is part of its 18th century strength and equally part of its 21st century weakness. Because it's all about places. Because places carry with them tradition, reason, an understanding of what you can and cannot do in people's homes. Man's home is his castle. The Fourth Amendment draws its strength from a magnetic relation between places where people are secure and places where cops need to be protected against by rules. It's hard to imagine how that could fail from an 18th century point of view. It's just a natural reflection of the order of the world. But the basic characteristic of society in the age of the net is that place disappears as a meaningful subject. The net deracinates everything. Hence the enormous difficulties of international regulation of things like gambling. You notice that those same islands in the Caribbean are doing a different but functionally similar job now. Antigua isn't where people from West Africa grow sugar under conditions of slavery for white people. Antigua is a place where internet casinos function. Because the sand of the island doesn't have to sop up the blood of its production of its commodities anymore. The net deracinates everything. As I showed in the first Snowden lecture, this is part of why despotism gets its oats up. Because instead of a clear distinction between not listening at home and stealing everything away, it lives in a mixed up 21st century where home and away don't distinguish anymore, and where all sorts of stuff is done in North America, which you would want to know about if you were trying to keep, well, a bus from blowing up in Jerusalem. So suddenly everybody needs to be everywhere. And place-based restriction ceases to have the protective function of limiting despotism. I don't want that to work for many. Some of those reasons are in Beijing. We don't live in a local world. And our concerns with surveillance, with spying, with maintaining the spook cop distinction, an American curiosity if ever there was one, all of the concerns we have about the social consequences of technology in the 21st century are fundamentally deracinated. They're not about places anymore. But for good and sufficient reason, adequate to make hundreds of years of doctrine workable in their context, place is everything here. That's mode of failure number 1A. The Fourth Amendment believes in the creation of privileged territory. This is obviously not just a 21st century problem. A man doing illegal gambling from a telephone booth in 1967 raises the same problem. This is why Katz is at one and the same time so theoretically important and so utterly ridiculous from a sociologic point of view. What the Supreme Court did in United States against Katz was to offer as an alternative to place an apparently similar idea, the reasonable expectation of privacy in the circumstances, geographic and social and so on. Katz makes it appear that there is some way in which a mere 20th century form of dematerialization called the telephone can somehow be substituted for as a place by the reasonable expectation of privacy, but we could call it reasonable expectation of place if we wanted to, and be accurate to the analysis of the cases. All those decades of absurdity about the closed container in the open car, and the open container in the closed car, and the plain sight, and the smell of the marijuana, they're all supposed to suggest that we're still operating in a world of places. But we're not, because Katz said we weren't. Katz said, what we were really operating in is a world in which there are some expectations of privacy that are reasonable, and some expectations of privacy that are unreasonable. And if the expectations of privacy weren't reasonable, then it wasn't a search. Now, you have to contemplate that with a certain degree of awe and amazement, right? What was done there was really and truly tricky. Search became a matter to be referred to the psychology of the individual, or as the law really likes to do it, the psychology of some non-existent individual, the reasonable one, the one whose psychology is not unduly paranoid nor unduly casual, but that one. And that which is not an invasion of that reasonable psychological state of expectation, not security, but expectation, is not a search. You have to love it. If I were the Ministry of State Security of the Chinese Communist Party's government of the People's Republic of China, I could not come up with something more devastatingly absurd. But if you sort of translate it, it begins to sound exactly like one of the 17 new principles or the 8 reasons or whatever such a regime would give. And that's Katz. That's the foundational understanding of the role of the Fourth Amendment in wiretapping in the late 20th century. About circuits, right? Fundamentally. About circuits. About specific conversations located in specific places occurring over telephone lines that you could specifically authorize a warrant to listen on. And even that, of course, is grossly overspecific from the point of view of late 20th century policing. As I pointed out in the first Snowden lecture, that restriction, the restriction to listening on a circuit, a telephone number, a place where you put the clips on the conductors, that regime, the one that Katz is legitimizing, the regime of police wiretapping, is at least capable of being squared at some general level with the grossly important particularity requirement of the Fourth Amendment. This number, conversations occurring here. And under 20th century non-digital analog conditions of wiretapping, particularity could therefore be said still to be a significant constraint. In the world in which I became a lawyer, in which Katz and the omnibus Safe Streets and Crime Reduction Act of 1968 and the Title III warrants, when that was high tech, when I started out, particularity meant you got a search warrant to tap a telephone, a Title III application, not really a search warrant, but you appeared before the district judge or the magistrate and you showed probable cause using an anonymous informants A, B, C, D, and E, and cops 1 and 2, and you got yourself an order that you could tap the phone of this particular Italian-American living in, Bethpage, let us say. And so somebody climbed a pole, and they put a pair of banana clips on a pair of conductors on a pole down the street, and they started listening to the home telephone of of Italian-American so-and-so. Well, it could have been an African-American, too. It was Nicky Barnes, let's say. We're going after the heroin business. We just need to listen to this phone. And what that meant was a guy sitting in a van with a tape recorder. And he turned that tape recorder on and off. That was particularity. See, if it was the kids talking on the phone, or the spouse, then you turn the tape recorder off, because they're not the targets of the warrant. And if the target of the warrant is talking to his lawyer, then you turn the tape recorder off, because you're not allowed to record attorney-client privilege conversation. So particularity is an analog engineering requirement. It's in the technology of recording. We don't record everything. We only record what we are specifically authorized to record, what the warrant says. And then when we come into court to admit the evidence of those conversations, the first thing we're going to have is lengthy cross-examination of the agents concerning the minimization log. That is the pieces of paper in which they wrote down the time of every telephone call and what they learned about who the telephone call was for and what was said and who it was who was participating, and therefore whether they turned the recorder off or left it on. And all that cross-examination produces its own kind of drama. But it stays within the frame of, were you recording what the warrant said you should be recording, or were you recording something else? Did you exceed the particularity? Did you drift in place? Well, place within telephone space rather than physical space. But if the guy left his house and went to talk on some other telephone, you didn't have a warrant for it. If you wanted to hear what he said in his social club, you had to hammer a spike mic into the outside wall of the social club. And for that, you needed a warrant. And of course, you got it, because you were Rudy Giuliani, and everybody knew what an upstanding guy. And all of that can adapt these unusually, what shall we say, specific requirements to the conditions of 20th century analog wiretapping. Well, I mean, you could do that as long as you had a Supreme Court judgment like that in Katz to help you do it. Because you needed to be able to say that some things that were physically and electrically absolutely indistinguishable from searching weren't searching. No search had occurred here, because no reasonable expectation of privacy had been invaded. You need that little circularity to make it all work, but you can do it. You can fit the cloth over the frame. Naturally, elite policing in the United States, the best criminal listening. Remember that the real listeners are out of this system altogether, right? The spook cop distinction is part of the background of the 20th century Fourth Amendment. When in 1947 we really got around to creating the national security state and making the listeners and doing all that was required to have a first-class system of despotism, it just didn't apply within the borders of the United States. When we did all that, we thought constitutionally this part of the world was being walled off from that part of the world, because our spooks couldn't talk to our cops, because secret police have no role in law enforcement, because listening abroad is fine and listening at home is verboten, because no, I can't listen to any telephone booth in Baltimore General, because that would be against the law. But that doesn't mean that everybody liked it. Of course they didn't like it. The spooks liked it well enough, because spooks don't want to be drawn into domestic law enforcement in the United States. Their motivations were different from those of most of the world's secret police, in addition to the legal requirements of their operations. This is a problem implicit inside the administrative functioning of all the other countries, and it is pretty much all the other nations of the world, in which no distinction is made between secret police and cops. in which the state, in its effort to subdue wrongdoing, is entitled to use all of the tools at its disposal everywhere all the time. That creates a tension which in the United States used to be institutionally reflected. Intelligence services don't want to prosecute people for crime. It's contrary to their purposes. The purpose of intelligence services is to know things. And the purpose of listeners is to know things that other people don't know you know. Every time that you, as an intelligence service, turn over information to secure a criminal prosecution, you're violating the first rule of intelligence work, which is never tell anybody anything unless it's doing something for you, which is better than what you're losing by giving up information. The listener's calculus in the United States could be pure in the period of the height of the American Empire because listeners could not be forced to violate the value of intelligence by surrendering it for mere criminal prosecution. That benefited them. But it didn't benefit the cops. It never benefits the cops. What benefits the cops is evidence. Cops, unlike intelligence services, have no use for things they learn. Things cops learn is just the stuff the cops carrying around inside their head that causes them to need more psychotherapy than they can get without reducing their manliness, of course. Cops don't want stuff they know. Cops know way too much. They want stuff they can prove because their job is to introduce people to the criminal justice process through the thing we call arrest, accompanied by admissible evidence that prosecutors can then use to secure convictions. Cops, in other words, want things that people will swear to, which is exactly what listeners don't have, because listeners will swear to nothing, ever. This institutional difference in motivation is important, even in systems in which it has no institutional requirement, in which there is no wall between the spooks and the cops. So what happens is that spooks are required to support domestic law enforcement and they lie their asses. Because there's no rule that says that spooks can't lie. Spooks lie all the time. That's what spooks do when they're not being listeners. The problem then in the United States at the end of the 20th century, in the period in which the first Snowden lectures is trying to explain Snowden, the problem at that period was that the overwhelming desire of law enforcement came to seem as though it was congruent with the overwhelming desire of the spooks and the national security officials. The precipitating incident, of course, is the occurrences of September 11th, 2001, which re-identified a series of national security goals in the United States in such a way as to make it appear that the spooks and the cops now had similar, maybe even identical motivations. This benefited the cops. The demands of law enforcement for listening power after September 11th were essentially the demand to eliminate the wall between the spooks and the cops. Spooks, well, it's a complicated story, and of course most of it we can't know if we don't have access to classified materials, which is your condition and mine. But the relationships between the intelligence services and law enforcement in the period immediately after September 11th, 2001 are a complicated story. That apparent alignment of motivations had more complexity to it than anybody, particularly the cops, would have wanted to admit. But the cops had a shopping list. They always had a shopping list. That shopping list existed after the first World Trade Center bombing in 95. It existed after the East African Embassy bombings. It existed after the coal. Each time some affray in the pathological relationship between the American Empire and Islam, every time some incident demonstrated that the cops could get the upper hand politically, they presented the same shopping list. It took in the fall of 2001 in a way it had never taken before. To John Conyers, in the House Judiciary Committee, all praise is due. He nearly single-handedly prevented the Patriot Act. And if Mr. Conyers had a little bit more backup in the United States Congress, particularly on the Senate side, we might, even in the fall of 2001, have escaped the Patriot Act. But it was really the same old coop spot, cop spook shopping list that had been sitting there all the way along. And under the particularly exigent political conditions of Washington in the late 2001, and without somebody on the Senate side, I guess that would mean without Patrick Leahy's having the same spine that John Conyers had, it came to be. So let us look a little bit at that shopping list. I mentioned, of course, the large-scale reconstruction of the telephone system to make listening possible in a digital environment. Right? That was a 90s problem. All that analog gear in the American telephone system, all those stepper bar exchanges, all those wires up there on the poles you could get to with the banana clips, all that fundamentally changes as the telephone system becomes a digital one rather than an analog one. As copper wires are replaced by filaments of glass, a tenth the width of a human hair, later a hundredth the width of a human hair. Digital telephone systems eliminate the clean relationship between circuit and call, which allowed particularity like placiness somehow to be captured in the law of wiretapping. If you've got a glass filament less than a human hair with 10,000 or 100,000 simultaneous telephone calls going through it, you can't just reach in with a pair of alligator clips and take the one you're looking for. You require that the entire system be architected from before it goes into service to allow you to steal the calls. You have to be inside machinery at the end of each of those filaments. You have to have the ability to unpack the content of the carrier to get to just the call you want, and the only person who can do that for you is the telephone company. By the time that problem became severe in the United States, by the time the conversion to digital telephony began to raise the question of whether wiretapping could occur at all, two things had happened in the United States. First of all, police had become absolutely dependent upon wiretapping. You can see how, in a case like Morgan, which I gave you, I know you don't want to read long district court opinions about mere facts and some scuzzy Hell's Angels and their meth business. But the 20th century implementation of the wiretapping rules, Title III and CATS and the whole structure, became absolutely the way the policing was done. If you didn't have wiretaps, what had you? And digital conversion of the telephone system threatened the ability, therefore, to do the form of surveillance-based policing which was characteristic of the late 20th century. The second thing that had happened is that the telephone monopoly had disappeared under the combined weight of neoliberal ideas about the market and government ideas about monopoly power, and the Bell system had become a series of independent entities, the AT&T and Southern Bell and Verizon's of the world, all digitizing at different rates and raising different particular cop headaches. And all of them ultimately really easy to deal with because these telephone companies had no morality, whatever. They just didn't want to have to pay for it. They weren't unpatriotic. They weren't going to prohibit the spooks and cops from pillaging the American telephone system. They just want to pay for the cost of it. And September 11th functioned very usefully in that it had wholesale destroyed a large piece of the telephone infrastructure of one of North America's major cities, and it required a lot of reconstruction, and, well, we had made a digital telephony deal in the mid-90s. The basic principle had become that the Congress would approve and the Supreme Court would leave alone and everybody would permit a massive re-engineering of the wiretapping system so that it was not a kludge on top, cops hacking the system, but a system built for cops to steal calls from it. And that decision having been made in 1995, by the time 2001 occurred and the cops were presenting the Cop Spook Consolidated Give Us the World shopping list, it was therefore easy to say that what we really want is to treat the telephone system the way it actually now exists, as our playground. So what were the shopping list elements that were being presented all through the 90s and that finally got enacted in the Patriot Act in 2001? The most important was the roving wiretap. Sounds simple. Listen, this is a bad guy. Sometimes he uses this phone. Sometimes he uses that phone. Sometimes he calls from the car. Let us listen to the bad guy. I mean, after all telephones are us, right? I mean, you know. Of course, when we accept the roving wiretap, we are basically eliminating all of this particularism. We've given up on place. We've given up on circuit. We're searching identities now. This bad guy, from any number, Your Honor, anywhere, wherever we can catch him, we got a system built for that. Let us run. Now we are no longer talking about a place, a person, to be sure. But the person as the locale specific to the government intervention is what despotism always wants. Despotism always just wants the bad guys, and some other bad guys, and the wives and children of the bad guys. But identity, rather than place, is already becoming the locus of search, the object. The other thing the Patriot Act did, as you will recall, is to eliminate that unnecessary wall between the spook and the cop. Once again, we need to concentrate on remedy. Before the Patriot Act, the receipt of information gotten from foreign intelligence services is prohibited in the United States court. Foreign intelligence service evidence is not admissible because spooks lie on it. Because forgery is what intelligence services do. Because making better than plausible falsehood is part of what they specialize in. And receipt of such evidence in the courts tarnishes the integrity of the courts by its nature. So we didn't used to allow it. Then we did. Now, of course, we have people who have been living on land belonging to the Cuban people in Guantanamo that we have a little fence around maintained by military force, and they have been living there for the longest time, and they will never be brought to trial because military trials are in fact inappropriate and civilian trials are impossible in the little hellhole we built for them. But really, we're holding them because we have some great information that says that they are terrible people. From whom did we get it? We got it from Mossad. And why did we trust it? Because Mossad would never lie to anybody? Or rather, because it's very convenient to have them do the work of forging. We can't do it. I mean, what would you do? Well, tell me, smartass, what happened? So, by removing barriers to the receipt of evidence from spooks, we deteriorated the line between the spook and the cop. And what we did was we left the American spook to say, yeah, but it wasn't my spook. And that turned out to be effective as a bargain. If you think that the resulting law enforcement and national security victories of the Bush and Obama administrations were victories, then this is how they were won. If you think that perhaps we assassinated too many people using drones and we ran too many concentration camps administered by the gentleman who was standing at this lectern before me, or any of those other things, then here would be an example of why the failure of the Fourth Amendment is predictable and why it is so serious. Any questions? Just about Waxman or about something else? Yes, Mr. Waxman, who was standing here before I arrived. Yes, that's a historical fact.
Can you develop a little bit? I don't know anything.
But just use Google. He's a well-surveilled individual. Are you surprised that war criminals teach in law school? Where would they work? Where would they work? So here then was the moment where the deterioration of the Fourth Amendment's relationship to the technology began to become more apparent. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant Google Matt Waxman later. You can, if it's been going on under your nose all this time, you could wait another 45 minutes. Or should we just recess now? Thought so. Okay, I got it wrong. I'll wait until you finish. When everybody has Googled, you can look up. Jesus. Naivete. I mean, it's just, it's so wonderful when you're as old as I am to understand that deeply the world is strange to those who haven't lived here all this time. No wonder it doesn't work. It assumes a level of alertness to the threat. How could this work when you all have smart-ass phones? How could this work when you think it's convenient to be surveilled at a level that no government should responsibly ever conduct, and it doesn't matter whether it's their Google VContact Tencent or not doing the surveilling? After all, we're still not really at grips with the issue, which is, why do you care so much about this? Isn't it perfectly okay that there's one of those in every seat in every room? Isn't it perfectly okay that all your classrooms rat you out all the time? Isn't it okay that your curricular delivery system keeps track of everything you read? How could this possibly be wrong? If that can't possibly be wrong, then how can this be right? But you've already accepted that. You're bought in. You're titillated by the idea that somebody might actually be a bad man in power. But the only way the bad man can be in power is because you really don't care. You see why it would be ridiculous to expect law to solve that problem. You see why it would be ridiculous to suppose that some dead Englishman fixed it for you. You see why you can't possibly really think that somehow some magic is going to come along and produce for you the freedom you gave away without a second thought. But here we are, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the belief that there is somewhere concealed in the U.S. reports a get-out-of-this-free card for people who have built it all around them and who feed it and shower it with their money and attention every day. Of course it doesn't work. So now we have to figure out what could law actually do for you. Not under the suspicion that it will do it all by itself, that it will just take care of it, that you'll never have to think about it again. But under the supposition that constitutional freedoms are made by people every single day in their real lives, what could this do for you? And still it will come up short. But at least we will have disposed of a number of pleasant untruths. That it's the fault of the Supreme Court. That the politics of the justices are wrong. that the structure of the thing is fine, but only the details are difficult or wrong, or that some cases were badly decided, or that some cops need to be reined in, or that it's the problem of some mayors or city councils or governors or senators. The right of the people to be secure is the people's right. Like the people's health, like the people's prosperity, like the people's ability to say what they want and spit on the eyes of, it's the eye of power, it's the people's responsibility.
Instruction that I provide.
Remember, says Cicero to Marcellus, everywhere you go, you are within the power of the emperor. That's the technological condition of the people of now. Wherever you go. Not because the emperor has a spy in every place, but because everywhere you go, you bring the spy with you. Because you've decided that's all right. You're wrong. You're actually wrong. Future generations will pay with loss of freedom for your indifference to the problem. And teaching here is really just an exercise in reminding you that there isn't any magic drama you aren't part of, at the end of which, happily, freedom is restored to you. Et Deus ex machina. What else was on the shopping list of the spooks and cops after 2001? Well, that's what Snowden came to say. What was on their shopping list was a bunch of technology for connecting the dots. You remember when the dots needed to be connected? You were the dots, but never. John Ashcroft, George W. Bush's Attorney General, who occasionally intervened in what we might think of as a libertarian direction during the course of his time, including a famous fight with White House counsel when he was hospitalized over the question of the breadth of searching of telephone records by the United States government. John Ashcroft said, it came to be known as the Ashcroft Rule, that information about Americans who had committed no offense, of whom nothing was suspected, information about innocent Americans should not be retained by the United States government through its listening programs for longer than 6 months, 180 days. That rule, that information about Americans about whom nothing was suspected, had to be purged from the listening programs after not more than 180 days, came to have a kind of constitutional resonance, a reasonableness quality to it, if you like. At the end of the first Obama administration, in 2012, on a rainy night in the middle of the winter, on a Wednesday, not a Friday, the Director of National Intelligence and the Obama Justice Department issued a press release in which they announced a modification to the Ashcroft rules, a spooking cop shopping list element, as you can see. The announcement was that instead of the maximum 180 days, the United States government would now authorize itself to keep intimate information about the communications patterns of Americans about whom nothing was suspected for a maximum of 5 years. I was teaching this class on a Thursday then, so the morning and the afternoon after that press release, I came into this class and I said, the only reason that they said 5 years was that there was no sideways eight in the font for the press release. So they picked the closest numerical approximation to infinity, which is 5 years. It was basically an announcement that we no longer care about the principle of minimization. We collect the evidence of everybody's telephone calls who is completely innocent and about whom we suspect nothing, and we keep it until the heat death of the universe. I did say that in this classroom. I was, of course, in ill temper as usual, but I also made a call to a friend in the White House who was a relevant decision maker. I said, huh, this was interesting. Well, my friend said, we've learned two things since the World Trade Center disaster. He said, first of all, we've learned that this idea of storing information among many different agencies and cooperating will not work. We need to put everything in one big place. That by which he meant the then secret U.S. Google in Bluffdale, Colorado, which keeps everything. Right? Second, he said, we've learned that we really need a robust social graph of the United States. I said. That sounds to me, if you translate it back into ordinary English, that the United States government now wishes to keep a list of everybody every American knows. I had a sound of, you know, don't quote me, agreement on the other side of the telephone line. And I said, okay, so I have, this raises for me a constitutional question. If you have been, if it is your intent to move us from what we have previously quaintly called a free society to a society in which the United States government keeps a list of every person every American knows, that's the robust social graph. If your plan is to move us from what we have previously regarded quaintly as a free society to a society in which you keep a list of everybody every American knows, could you just fill me in on what constitutional procedure should be used for that purpose? Should there be, I said, for example, a law? And he just laughed at me because, of course, they had done it by a press release between the Director of National Intelligence and the Justice Department on a rainy Wednesday evening in March when no one was looking. And that was our friends, okay? That was the political party on our side. That was Barack Obama himself. It was very close to himself, right? One hop from Barack Obama, that decision was made in the Oval Office with other people present, including the person I was talking to. And at that moment, the nature of American society changed as described by the means described. Nothing in this language has anything to do with that, of course. Nothing. Nothing. And the fact that they got that robust social graph from Facebook and you helped them make it? Nothing. Totally nothing. Pay no attention. You were the little man behind the curtain, but pay no attention to the little man behind the curtain anyway. That's how it changed. This is why the constitutional liberty is not defensible without the people themselves defending it, because otherwise it's a press release on a rainy Wednesday evening in March. Because the shopping list is always there. Power always knows how it could do a better job. And this was the essence of the political theory of Edward Snowden. The people should at least be informed, should they not? Snowden thinks. If it takes espionage against our own government to know, then best we do it. And really, a rule that says that this or that cannot be introduced as evidence in a criminal that has all the force of matchsticks. against the actual shopping list and the real intention and what we have learned since 2001. So we created a network, a nervous system for the entire of humanity, and we began encouraging everybody to put everything in it. And we offered them baubles in return for the putting everything in it. And those baubles were gratefully accepted, and everybody said how convenient it was, and we had the basis upon which to obliterate all of this. Yep.
These private companies can always refuse to cooperate with the government.
No, they can't. How can they? What refusal are you talking about?
Apple didn't want to...
No, that's wrong. Apple just played a little drama and you bought it.
Okay.
Right? What ultimately happened? Apple told a third-party contractor how to break into the cell phone of a dead terrorist and everybody declared it over.
I thought the government itself found an Australian hacker...
Oh, I wonder. I wonder. Do you think by any chance the Australian hacker was not Julian Assange? The structures of complicity are what? What is the NSA code name for AT&T? Somebody surely picked up that little detail along the way. What is the code name by which AT&T is referred to inside the NSA? Snowden told you all about it. They're called Fair Play. If the listeners think the telephone company X should be called Fair Play, you can imagine how fairly it plays with them. We've talked already a little bit about Apple. There is this enormous foundry for the production of art, and there is no artist in it, because the king of the undead now dead didn't want to have a successor. He destroyed that possibility. Instead, he made the plastics buyer cheap. The foundry manager, the brass buyer for the statue maker, is the chief of this lumbering zombie which cannot produce magic because the magician died and deliberately destroyed the magic behind him. So the plastic buyer, Tim Cook, that is his job. He was a superb plastics buyer. I said that. Everybody always knew it. The plastics buyer must now have a role as Wizard of Oz, but he isn't a wizard. He's a little man behind the curtain who buys plastic. So what does he do? He shows the values of the jewelry owners. He enacts being the sort of person you like to think you are and that the cult mark on the back of your stuff says you are, an Apple person. I have these wonderful values. I'm an Apple person. I'm a creative. I think different, etc., 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 etc. So Mr. Cook's primary task has nothing to do with making the product, which he cannot do. It has nothing to do with creating, one more thing, insanely great. He cannot do that. He can buy the plastic. He can maneuver Foxconn. He can poison Chinese workers without your thinking of the thing you're holding as a blood diamond. But mostly what he has to do is pretend to have your values. And so, of course, he pretends to be very much in favor of your privacy, which means he collects all your data and shares it with only the people he pleases, not the people Google pleases. And all this stuff is the playing out of that drama. And apparently it works, because you thought he was on your side. That's the beauty of it. No, when you get an order from the United States government through its legitimate court system telling you to do a thing, of course you do it. Your lawyers tell you to do that. Unlike the king of the undead now dead, who allowed his general counsel to be disbarred for him, Mr. Cook doesn't play that way. They obey the orders they receive. Of course, if they receive orders they are allowed to resist while they, with another hand, fulfill, they will do that. And of course, it would be wise of the United States government to do that. But imagine the dialogue when the French show up, as they do every year or two, and say in the nice quiet rooms in Washington, why aren't you cracking down on Apple, which is the world's greatest facilitator of terrorism? That's the usual Gaffa conspiracy line of the French military intelligence when they get to the United States and conduct these meetings. Once I succeeded in having a spy in the room. So at second hand, I know what was said, as opposed to third hand. As usual. But that performance, too, is just a little play. And then the Americans solemnly explain that there's a spook cop distinction in the United States. And what they can do in national security cases is not what they can do in ordinary criminal law enforcement. And the French titter in this supercilious, you barbarians kind of way. And they all pretend that they have once again heard a thing that they completely don't believe. Of course there's no spook cop distinction. How could you be the Americans? We hate you, but we sort of respect you. And how could you exist with a spook cop distinction? Everybody understands that that can't exist. And then that little kabuki theater is played out. All of these things have old, old reaches now. There's no part of this that hasn't been done a bunch of times. But nobody invited you. And the only person who ever told you was Edward Snowden. And of course, what they tried to do was to throw him in jail and lose the key. Or maybe just put the key underneath him in the body bag locked on the thing, but you know. Not very important. The show must go on. But of course, any constitution purporting to protect individual liberties is going to be treated as a no-op by power as many times as you can get away with it. It's not as though we should be surprised that all this theater of constitutional non-relevance what goes on. But now we have to come back to the most difficult of points, which is that there really is no difference between the Apple Computer Corporation and a merchant in sugar with a warehouse in Boston in 1795, or 1767 for that matter. They are third parties in possession of other people's stuff. And their interest is not in protecting other people's rights. Their interest is in running their business. And if a guy shows up at your warehouse door and he's got a warrant and he says, I wish to search these barrels in your warehouse to see who hasn't paid taxes on the molasses contained therein, of course you have to cooperate. There's no right of yours which is in any danger. You're not in any risk of unreasonable search and seizure. He's standing in your warehouse, he has a warrant. It's true that some other sugar merchants or ship captains or troublemakers in town might be eager for you to make a fuss and die on the hill of their rights, but the law doesn't sustain you in that. The law asks whether you are being subject to unreasonable search of your place of business, and the answer is no, you're not. An independent magistrate made a finding on, supported by oath or affirmation, that there is evidence of crime in your warehouse, and that you have to listen to. Everybody in this room who is not a citizen of the United States is subject to arbitrary and intensive surveillance conducted by Columbia University for the purpose of disclosing secrets you don't want disclosed to a government which is not your own. Every single one of you. The relevant mechanism is the National Security Letter, a mere object of administrative force which says to Columbia University, spy the fuck out of the following foreigner. Right? That is the law, you know. It's the law, or if you bother to look, you know it's the law. And not only that, but the National Security Letter says, and you may not disclose the existence of this letter, so help you God, or we will make things bad for you. Because it would be contempt. And so what does the university do? It rolls over and it spies the fuck out of you. Of course it does. And it doesn't tell anybody. Of course it doesn't. The one subject of interest might be, dear Lee Bollinger, you great First Amendment libertarian and constitutional big person, would you mind telling us how many national security letters you have to spy the fuck out of the members of our community, please? The law doesn't prohibit you from saying that, Mr. Bollinger. And it doesn't. But I can assure you that after 20 years of pressure on the subject, we still have never been told, not once, of how many national security letters this excellent university is the recipient. But why should you do anything about that? After all, you're a person. You're here. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says you have rights. It doesn't say those rights are the rights of citizens. But for all practical purposes, you have no rights at all. And nobody will tell you when they're being violated. And nobody will tell us, whose community it is, how many people we are doing that to. We, our community, are doing that to. Thank you, Professor Bollinger. Thank you, deeply, from the bottom of my heart. Now, have we a constitutional cause of action? No, we have not. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects? Well, it may be it's not an unreasonable search and seizure. Maybe it's not a search. Maybe you don't have a legitimate expectation of privacy, being a university student from abroad in the United States. Maybe none of this is searching. That would certainly be convenient. That would explain the cowardice of big people. And you think that the leadership of Apple and Google is more courageous than Lee Bollinger? Little respect as I have for the courage of Lee Bollinger, I must tell you, no, he's as courageous as they come, anyway. I represent sometimes technical workers, you know, people I have known for decades who make software and give it away, and sometimes they wind up being, I don't know, the postmaster of a major public university. And so maybe one night I get a telephone call in a panicked form out of time zone from a guy who says, I have been ordered to turn over all the email of a student in my university. And when I ask to see the order, I am told that I must not ask. What should I do? And I say, well, do you want to be employed in the morning? If you want to be employed in the morning, then you do exactly what you were told and you shut the fuck up. Because if you don't do what you're told and shut the fuck up, then you won't be working in the morning. I was not a lawyer in the Soviet Union. I was just a foreigner in the Soviet Union. But if I had been a lawyer in the Soviet Union, I would, of course, have given exactly the same advice to such a person. If you want to believe that the Fourth Amendment is going to do something, then you have to imagine that something is going to be done by people who aren't the Fourth Amendment. You have to imagine a politics which is different, as well as a technology which is different, in order to expect the law to be different. It's not the principles which are at fault. It's everything that's at fault. It's the history and the tradition and the structures, and the cowardice of the legislators, and the overweening power hunger of the cops and the spooks, and all the other pieces in between, which include the profit makers and you. We can't analyze this as just a legal problem. We can't say, oh, but the retrograde Supreme Court, the over-originalist conservative justices, we can't do any of that. That's all just music to the ears of people who want to sleep peacefully. That's why we begin with tragedy. That's why the Fourth Amendment is such a downer. And I'm not even done. I'm only two-thirds of the way through. More questions? surely by this point there should be a reason to disagree. What could I possibly have done to polarize the matter further that I haven't already? And how could I possibly have been any more unpolite than to point out to you that this is the world you made and you're responsible for? Surely by this time there must be somebody who wants to say, no, no, no. It isn't like that. Your facts are wrong. Your analysis is mistaken. You don't know what you're talking about, Edwin. It's just pure Marxist ranting. No? Yeah. Don't bother. It won't work.
Just by instinct. Do you think there's actually something we can do to make sure the Fourth Amendment protects the privacy of people?
Yes, of course I'm sure. I wouldn't be standing here wasting your time with all this deprecatory language. If I didn't think you could fix it, why would I be saying anything? Now, do you want to ask me what?
What?
Do you want to ask me what you can do? Or was it merely a question, do I think there's something you can do? If that was the question, I'd answer it. I think you might have had a different question.
What do you think we can do?
You could store it at home. You could reorganize your technical life so that all that behavior information about you is sitting in a hard drive under your bed. You could make them get a warrant. Why not? You didn't have to roll over and let them scratch your tummy. You didn't have to let them give you free email in return for listening to everything you say. You could decide to refuse to live in a society in which your university monitors from moment to moment and page to page how you read the homework. You could stop reaching to turn on the microphone every time you have something to say. You could stop giving every kind of permission to this behavior. Does that mean that everything will be fixed overnight? No. It means that there will be some litigation. It means that the real issues will be raised. It means that you won't sleepwalk through the thing. And you could very well say to Lisi Bollinger, you know, we refuse to pay tuition unless you at least tell us how many secret orders from the United States listeners you have obeyed recently and how little you are doing to keep the Ministry of State Security out of your classrooms. Again, I say, why are these microphones off? I know what the reach of the Hong Kong national security law is. Everybody knows what the reach of the national security law is. And everybody knows what the principle of the Chinese government is with respect to listening abroad. This university owes privacy. This university should be committed to privacy. This university should be hearing a lot of complaining from you when it refuses to back your educational privacy. It hears none, and you have none. Do I think there's something you could do? Yes. And that was just my first suggestion. I have a few more. Anybody who wishes to drop a smart-ass phone in here on the way out, please feel free. I know how many will be in there, and so do you, right? Because it's so convenient. Because it's so wonderful. Because everything works so well. Frederick Douglass said, when his owner's husband ordered her to stop teaching him to read, because teaching slaves to read only makes them angry and sad and disrespectful, Frederick Douglass said in his first autobiography, as you recall, I pointed out in the Second Stone Lectures, now, he was 10, now, I suddenly understood the thing that had been confusing to me all this time. What was the source of the power of the white man over us? Huh. Like him, now you know. Like him, your question is, what could I do about this? Unlike him, your answer is, I am not determined to find out. I will not risk my life to discover. I will not take any very substantial chances at all. I will not inconvenience myself. So what happens when freedom is injured and those whose freedom has been taken will not inconvenience themselves? What happens? The idea that somebody will come out of the past, some old white savior, and say, okay, well, it's okay, you're taken care of, that will be wrong. That's the importance of the dual constitutional tradition in America, which I spoke of in the second slide. There have always been two constitutional traditions in America. There was the constitutional tradition of those who had, which involved assuring themselves that they would never be made slaves, and the constitutional tradition of those who were imprisoned in this society by virtue of their birth and whose job it was to run away in order to be free. Those are both constitutional traditions. They exist all the time, everywhere, in every case you read, in every statute that you look at, in every piece of the history you learn, unless the state legislature has come along and said that piece of the history may not be taught in this state because it might make children uncomfortable. I am, of course, engaged in doing what those statutes prohibit. I'm trying to make you feel uncomfortable. But I'm a law professor, so everybody takes for granted. The second constitutional tradition is the one that you require. The second constitutional tradition is the one in which Edward Snowden, whether he knows it or not, is a participant. That constitutional culture believes that the rights that are desired, the ones that every human being ought to have, will never be gained unless they're struck for. That they will disappear. And whatever originalism means, it ought to mean that, because those folks were aware of that. They were determined not to be reduced to slavery. They said it all the time, and they knew of what they spoke. But remember that the structure of all this implies that unless you're doing that, it's always a third party who would have to answer for your rights. A warehouseman, data processor, a data miner, a platform company, a telecom. It's always somebody else, another merchant warehouseman with a bunch of stuff in his storage. I can sort of understand the belief in the immense human generosity of Tim Cook that he will fight those battles for you. That's the sweetness of his nature. That lovely boy from northern Alabama, that hymn-singing, gay, marginalized figure growing up knowing about the importance of human privacy rights, it's very heartstring tugging and all that. But of course it isn't real. Who's going to die on a hill for the rights you've thrown away? Even if it didn't hurt their profit. This is the hard part. So there are technical measures you can take. And there's politics. There's the real discussion. A real discussion which is waged not just in avoiding stupid Twitter wars or writing at length in The Nation or the National Review. The kind of politics that people who are planning to be lawyers, members of the ruling class of the world, know how to engage in. You all understand perfectly well what it would mean. You understand what it would take. You're just not inclined to do it. But if you change your mind, journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. No, thanks. thank you. We'll keep our KGB issued machine. Of course we will. It's so convenient. You see how badly KGB screwed up. If they'd done it right, they could have issued surveillance devices to every Russian and charged them $1,000 for it and listened to and surveilled every single thing that happened. But you know, of course, where Tsar Vladimir's smart ass phone is. You're well aware he doesn't carry one, correct?
I think it's easier
to that tradition, though. Yes, it is, you're right. I mean, this is the whole point about the second constitutional tradition in America, right? Who would ever have done it that way if there hadn't been poor people who were enslaved? That's right, it's really easy. That's absolutely true. You're right. And our traditions, both of them, accept the reality of that. And the reason we are where we are is exactly the moment at which people who aren't powerful and rich decide that they're going to do it anyway. I'm not afraid of your jail because I want my freedom. That's when it begins. And so here I am, carrying along old rhetoric and old ideas and theories from the 18th century, falling apart as we carry them, trickling out through our fingers like sand, asking exactly the question you are asking. Right? When does this become a matter not of the high tradition, but of the real tradition? When does this become a matter not of what it says in the books that rich people can get when they want it? When does this become a matter of the people freeing themselves? When? And I don't know the answer. But that's what I'm standing here. You will be the ruling class of the world in the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. This is what you're up against. And the rest of it is you. What will come out is what you put in. You want to try and restore place to the Fourth Amendment? Put your data at home. Make them get a warrant. What practicing lawyer in the United States should be practicing on Google Drive or Gmail or Dropbox? Everything they could possibly want is on the spindles in my apartment. 20 terabytes of highly encrypted material. They want it? They can come and get a warrant. I will be happy to hand them the drives. Good luck to them. But a $75 Freedom Box and a $40 external hard drive, and you're in exactly the same position I am. You're just using less heavy iron. There's a box, a piece of machinery, and a virtual machine on that piece of machinery, and a whole bunch of carefully encrypted DAS connected to that machinery, all of which is solely for the purpose of receiving my email. I don't have the slightest doubt about the quality of the best team on earth. I know exactly how good the best team on earth is. And therefore, I believe, as a friend of mine said, tailored access operations is always efficient. I said, yes, they are. I don't think there's anything they ever wanted to get into they didn't get into sooner or later, but it doesn't scale. Yes, that's right, he said, it doesn't scale. I suspect if the United States government wants to read my email, they can do it if they're willing to spend $100 million getting it. Same for the Chinese Ministry of State Security. Their teams are good enough. My tricks are no better than the best. And they're the best. But they have to want it. They have to want it retail. They have to want to spend the money and the effort. They can't just take my mail along with all of yours by going to the one place where everybody dumps it. They have to do it retail. They can't do it wholesale. You want to change the political economy of thuggery in the 21st century? That's how. Make them do it retail. Change it from mass surveillance back into surveillance. A circuit, a person, a place, a thing, for which it turns out the rules are pretty good. That's why I still spend all my effort, technically as well as administratively, to assure that professional material is done over the telephone, not over some Zoom link, not over some VoIP intermediary, not over some Skype shit. A telephone number, because there are rules about telephones. Because the law of 1968 is a whole lot more favorable to us than it is if we're Zooming. You want to get a telephone tap on a lawyer's office? It requires retail effort. Somebody in the Justice Department has to think about it. Yes, I know that there are plenty of circumstances under which that warrant will be granted. But I know that that's a whole lot less than what it takes to steal a Zoom call. Can the best team on earth listen to this classroom now? Of course they can. All they have to do is hack the control room here. But the control room has lost these microphones. They're not working. So they're going to have to do a really good job. They can't just go to AWS and hack the Echo 360 recording that was made automatically in this room. They can't just go to the control room and say, well, give us what's going on in 102B. They've got to hack deeper. They've got to hack past what I did. And what I did was specifically designed to be something that the guys in the control room complain about all the time because I took their microphones away. And if I don't forget to turn them back on, then whoever next walks in here, the classroom will still be electrically dead. Can you do that? Yes, you can do that. Of course you can do that. But you don't want to. I might get in trouble. You're right. I have tenure. Even if restoring educational privacy were an offense, they couldn't can me for it. But first we'd have to have a little conversation about whether restoring educational privacy is an offense. That's why part one is so much happier than part four. That's why I start with the tragedy, because by the time we get to part one, we're in a much happier state. The First Amendment works much better for us. It isn't restricted to places and things. It doesn't assume that everything happens in a place. Okay, you're right. It's late, and there are no office hours. See you in a week.